Okay, I think we're on the air again.
Okay.
And we're talking about your professor at Ohio State.
Lasseter was another professor who was new, and he was working on physical organic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went around and interviewed most of these people and ended up choosing Wolfram because he had this program on Osage Orange pigments, and that was going in the direction that I sort of got interested in, plant chemistry and organic combined. Evans wanted me to work for him very much, but I didn't want to do carbohydrates. And
but you did. But you did eventually.
I did, yes.
That's faith for you, isn't it?
Things change the way you don't expect. But I worked 3 years on the pigment, no, 2 years on the plant pigment. And then I got, I couldn't find a job, and that was in 1940. And
Well, you were still in graduate school in 1940, weren't you?
You didn't get your PhD in
42, wasn't it?
In the spring of 1940.
Oh, yeah.
And then I couldn't find a job. Went all over.
What did you do? Write a lot of letters? Or
I wrote a lot of letters.
Including DuPont?
Yeah, I interviewed DuPont.
And that,
all sorts of places. And,
was 1940 was not a good year, we I recall, wasn't it?
No, didn't seem to be.
even though the war broke out in Europe.
Shortly after. Yeah, it was going on in Europe by then, yeah. So Wolfram had this cellulose fellowship, which was sponsored by DuPont, actually, and the person who was on it had been on it 1 year, and there was one more year to go, and so I took that over and had it for a year.
And so that was your postdoc at Ohio State.
Mm-hmm.
And what did they pay you for that on the postdoc?
I got $2,000.
Not too bad.
No, it was pretty good after
when you consider that the starting salary for PhDs was $3,000 back then.
Yeah, that was in the range of PhD salary.
Mm-hmm.
I was married by then. I'd been married for a year.
Mm. Well, where did you meet your wife? At Ohio State?
No, she was from Thomaston, Maine.
Oh.
And
So when you went back in summer times, that's when you're recording her then, huh?
That's right.
And Christmas time and all the holidays.
That's right. When I could get back, and
was she in college then?
She was working there in Thomaston as a housekeeper and with a family and getting board and room, some pay. And, we got married when I was in my last year. And we went out there and rented an apartment.
This is 1940.
It was 1939.
Oh,
39,
right.
So 39, 40, and then 40, 41 we were
and there. Then she moved to Columbus while you were a postdoc.
Yeah.
How did she like Columbus when she first moved there? It was a shock to her.
It wasn't too bad, but it was a dirty city at that time because everybody burnt off coal.
Yeah.
But it's a fairly mild climate.
Oh, and it's not as mild as Delaware.
Oh, no.
It's mild compared to Maine, is what you're saying.
It's mild compared to Maine. But
most places in the country.
And Columbus was a big city, but it was not as big as it is today, like all cities.
Yeah.
Yeah. She used to walk up to the lab every night and stay up there until I got through about 11 o'clock at night.
And you started at what time in the morning?
And I was up there in the morning. certainly by 8 o'clock.
And it was a long day then, huh?
Yeah.
This is, you were still a graduate student and you were married in 39. So you're still in the lab for 8 to 11, and as a postdoc, you're still from 8 to 11?
Yeah.
It's a matter of habit, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
Now, you couldn't do this in Buffalo when you went to Buffalo for DuPont.
So. Well, that was a vacation compared to
Could you, when you went to DuPont, could you work more than 8 hours a day if you wanted to? Like, you could experimental stuff.
You weren't supposed to because of safety reasons. And I did go in on Saturdays some when we had special projects going.
Didn't you have to work Saturdays when you first went
to
DuPont?
Well, in the beginning we did, yes, that's right.
Until 1945, by the way I recall.
And, when I first went there, they were working Saturday morning. And then when the, and,
tell me about your reactions to your colleagues at Ohio State, the fellow students, fellow graduate students, and those are your professors. What were your reactions to them?
My reactions to them?
Yeah. Particularly at first. coming from Maine.
I've got along very well with nearly all the professors. I guess some of the people in the freshman area I didn't care for too much.
You're talking about the people you had to be an assistant to, you mean?
Yeah.
You're talking about the students and the...
Quill and I didn't get along too well. I know you knew.
Now, he was the professor for the general chemistry.
Yeah. He was professor of inorganic and general
school.
Chemistry.
I spelled Quill.
Quill.
Just like it sounds, okay.
Just like it sounds. And he was a military type, ran things with a high degree of discipline.
When he lectured, did you have to sit in the lecture too? Or is that just one of the assistants sat in the lecture?
Well, we did some. Evans did some lecturing.
For general chemistry. So they did separate the lecturing from the laboratory. The professors did.
And yes, we had to sit in there. There were a large number of assistants. I suppose there must have been, I guess, without knowing for sure, there might have been 50 assistants. And they had an assistant in charge, and he had an assistant. So it was a very highly organized teaching staff.
This is the way Quill organized it, or this is the way that all the professors organized it?
Well, yeah, it was organized under Quill. Quill?
Who was head of the Department of Ohio State then, the chemistry department?
Evans.
Evans.
Mac had been, and Evans was the head. Then.
And Evans was for the... several years ago in graduate school.
Yes.
Did he influence you at all, Evans?
Not a lot. I liked him and got along well with him, but we didn't have a lot of contact.
Did he talk chemistry with you? Did he talk chemistry with you, or was it always business?
No, other business mostly. Didn't talk much chemistry. The teachers, I'm trying to think who I had. I had Johnson in thermodynamics and Cornelius in inorganic. Cornelius is still at Kent State as a adjunct professor or something.
Yeah. And he and I are on the nomenclature committee together. He's a consultant, so am I, in nomenclature.
He was a real dynamic type of person and had inorganic chemistry very well organized. I learned a lot from him. I had Board and organic, and I did take some. Well, I had analytical organic. And
who'd you take that under?
That was under board, but it was taught by an assistant whose name I don't remember.
Oh. Well, how about your colleagues or the other graduate students? Any of them very close friends with you?
Well, I roomed with a fellow named Blomqvist, who later came to DuPont. He was a physical chemist, and Robert Griffith, who went with Eastman Kodak, he was a physical chemist. Who else? I worked with Stan, colleagues in the research area were Stan Gregory. He worked for DuPont and then for Weyerhaeuser. A fellow named Wiest, who went with DuPont and Orkamp.
Quite a few of you went with DuPont then, huh?
A lot of went. DuPont hired a lot of people. They went to different departments.
It seemed to me one or two of them came to Hercules, too, from Ohio.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I can't picture who might be at that period, though. Yeah.
I knew Buckingham, who was in... he's in Wilmington now. He worked down in Baltimore for DuPont. I guess that's in pigments. Soudan, Frank Moody, who used to live in this neighborhood, was at Ohio State. And
were most of your friends, the year you entered Ohio State, were most of your friends the first year graduate students, or were they? Was it more democratic and you were friends with the second, the third, and fourth year graduate students and postdocs?
Well, yeah, I didn't get to know many students or many people who were not in the graduate school and who were in chemistry at some time or other. I think that's generally true. I knew some people because I roomed with them.
And also you shared laboratories with some, I assume, didn't you?
Yeah.
For your thesis work?
Well, I had a laboratory with Sean Mahan, and Mahan went with he went with Phillips Petroleum, I think.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went with another company. I'm trying to remember what it was. And Lee Benton, who was another lab partner, he went into teaching at a small school in Illinois.
Did you have any desire to be a professor? As you were approaching your PhD, end of your PhD, or during it,
I didn't consider that.
But that was a bad year, isn't it?
It was a bad year to get a job anywhere.
Protecting the university, there was. They were trying to recruit us for the armed forces back in 1940, weren't they?
Yes, not. There was some of that.
I guess that began.
We weren't in the war until that fall.
Yeah.
Right after
But they were recruiting us. We had to go before a board and get a number and that sort of stuff.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. We had that.
Were you close to being drafted at any time?
Yes. I got to third. We had a student. We had a number of students. In fact, we had some student assistants in the labs, in the research lab, and some of them were suspect. I just remember that rather vaguely. They were, well, I know they were investigated as to whether they were...
These were singers in the college thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were being paid by the government somehow as assistants. And there was some kind of a paid arrangement. And but they were being investigated as to their political background and stuff like that.
Oh boy.
And we had trouble with that sort. We had trouble getting them deferred. Of course, I was up late 20s, and as soon as I went to DuPont and began to get a 1A, not a 1A, but a deferment, while I was at DuPont, after the war, of course, the programs began to change, research programs. But gasoline was short. I went to Maine on a 2-week vacation, and my draft board was in.
Was in Maine.
Somebody saw me. I immediately got changed to 1A, and the company had to fight to get me to 3rd again.
Yeah, that happened to quite a few of us that attended from small towns.
Yeah,
we were at Big City University, and our draft board was in a small town.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a real headache. Now, how did you decide on your thesis? Did Mel Wolfram decide on your thesis, or did you decide it was going to be Osage, or did he decide that? Or he convinced you that this is what you
should. He convinced me that this is a good book. He had this program on Osage Orange pigments. It was already going, and he had two other students on it already. And one of them was Bill Hess, and Hess came to DuPont too. He worked in the personnel department. And
that's not very close to a pigment. Osage pigment, is
no. I had accepted the fact I'd work on the Osage Orange pigments, and because he assigned what part of that program that we would do. This was still back in the times when you hit everything with a sledgehammer in order to analyze.
You did all your analytical work too, I assume, didn't you?
We did a lot of it. We didn't do carbon hydrogen.
Or did someone else do that for you?
We sent it to Germany.
Oh.
Wolfram didn't trust American analysts.
Oh no, but, well, I was in grad school the same time you were, but we had to do our own carbon hydrogens.
Oh, I see. Well,
and nitrogens. You did your own nitrogens? You didn't have any nitrogen compounds. Yes, you did, too.
Yeah.
And you had some nitrogen compounds.
We did our own nitrogens and acetyls and alkoxyls.
Did you do it by the macro analysis or the semi-micro?
Semi-micro.
But not your carbon hydrogens.
So we didn't do carbon hydrogens. And later on, there was a chemist funded there at Ohio State who did them, and he became reliable in Wolfram's eyes.
Who paid for the carbon hydrogen analysis, you or the university?
It was the university. It was paid out of research funds that somebody had, Wolfram had access to, I guess.
Yeah, he and Brody had quite a few of them.
Yeah. And but he was, well, he'd become convinced that this is the way to do it. When he didn't send them there, he sent them to some other American laboratories that did carbon hydrogen.
And then your PhD thesis was on the Osage Orange pigment then? Or when did you get to the isoflavones? Was that as your postdoc?
That's what these... that's what these pigments turned out to be.
Yeah, I know. But first you had to determine the composition.
Oh, yes, all right.
I see, but yeah, but wasn't that your thesis, the determination of the composition of Osage orange pigment? Which is a nicer flavor, I know.
That's what it was. Yeah.
Then you did research on isoflavones as a chemical, as an entity by itself.
Well, we did do some work on that, but mostly as a practice to understand how
the pigment works,
how they differed from the Osage orange pigments themselves.
So actually, then. He went through reactions of the isoflavones, I think.
Yeah. So we looked up a lot of chemistry on natural pigments and how to characterize them.
So you had to read a lot of German for your project.
Yes, we had to read a lot of German. That's right.
And of course, you had your nose in Baustein every week too.
Yes. And we were reading Rilstetter and all the other guys.
Yeah.
Area and
yeah, beautiful publications. Yeah, beautiful publications.
So we got to appreciate that, and they did work on very small quantities, and of course that's what this whole program had to be worked out on, fairly small quantities, but not micro quantities.
No, still, there's only so many micro back those days.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Now, how about the gluconates? When did you get to those? Was that your postdoc?
In the what?
The gluconates.
Yeah, that was in the postdoc.
That was your postdoc.
Yeah.
How about cellulose? When did you hit cellulose?
Well, the cellulose was in the postdoc too. We were trying to.
And this was the water-soluble cellulose first.
It was water-soluble. Wolfram had a program on heparin. And he wanted to work on cellulose sulfate and other cellulose derivatives.
Well, how did he go from heparin to cellulose to the water side of cellulose?
Well,
there's no relationship there.
It never did have much relationship,
okay.
I guess. He just thought it might.
But that's a mistake he made.
Yeah, that's right. I don't even know why we were working on the gluconates, except he had some idea that he was going to make a super explosive or something by nitrating some of these things.
Oh.
And
mm-hmm. Was this the sugar part or the what part did he want to nitrate?
We made it.
Wasn't the gluconate itself he wanted to nitrate, is it?
We made a gluconated cellulose and he wanted to nitrate that.
Then he nitrated the cellulose, the hydroxyl groups in the cellulose.
Yeah.
Did the nitric acid, sulfuric acid mixture eat up the gluconate? Didn't it destroy the gluconate?
Well, I guess it did. We didn't get very far with that.
If you're going to nitrate cellulose, you have to
Dissolve it.
You have to have a lot of nitro groups, of course, in explosive grade.
Yeah, well, that's true. We didn't get very far.
You didn't get that far, huh? Okay. But anyway, it got you into the literature. I noticed you have a publication, the Survey of the Literature, you say.
Yes.
That must have been one hell of a lot of reading.
It was. Literature, there were some 300 references I ended up with at the time.
At least, yes.
And I was, some of them I was translating and all that.
You're translating for Wolfram or for yourself?
I had to write an abstract of each article.
Well, since you're at Ohio State, did you ever have any relationship with chemical abstracts?
Yes, I got to be an abstractor.
And what year?
For them.
You knew Jay Crane then very well.
Yeah, E.J. Crane, yeah.
What year did you become an abstractor?
I was abstracting while I was at Ohio State, and then after I left for a number of years, back when they had individual abstractors.
Yeah.
And they had a long list of people that were doing the abstracting.
I just wonder who was there first, you or me. That's why I'm asking.
Oh, this was 1940.
You were there first, I think.
Yeah.
Before you got your PhD, you beat me to it then.
Right.
I think Crane Crane recruited me, I think, in 45.
I see. Yeah, so it was a little bit before then. I don't remember when I stopped.
And it, of course, this was... Did you have a specific field when he recruited you, or is it just organic chemistry, or physical chemistry, or what?
I was doing organic chemistry mostly, and a fair amount of cellulose, but also...
Well, that would be a separate section from the organic.
I think partly I was picking up all the chemistry they didn't have anybody to do, because I was doing French and German, which is tough, and that's a tough way to make it. Any money on it. He didn't make any money anyway.
I asked him to give me only French and German.
Uh-huh.
But they started sending me a bunch of English patents.
I see.
And I revolted against that. I said, look, I can read English very, very well. It's a French and German I want to be expert at.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting.
That was kind of fun, but time consuming.
As soon as we went to DuPont in 1942, is that right? When did you join DuPont in Buffalo? What year? What year did you go to DuPont in Buffalo?
Yeah, Charts was the laboratory director, and he came out recruiting. In
41, you joined.
That was in
you joined 41. DuPont in 1941.
Yeah.
Now, you were in the fibers department, I assume.
Yes, it was called the rayon department.
Rayon department, then. That's right. And what was your first assignment in Buffalo?
I worked on cellulose. As I said, the first thing he asked for was 2 pounds of cellulose sulfate. But actually, I was working on cellulose acetate and hydroxyethyl cellulose. They had a program on...
Now, this was in a research laboratory.
Yeah, in a research.
Had nothing to do with the plant at all.
Oh, no. This was the pioneering research laboratory's beginning. It eventually became the pioneering research lab at the experimental station.
Did you know Will Smith up there in W.W. Smith when he was in Buffalo?
There was a Smith in the patent division.
Well, eventually, but first he was in the laboratory.
I didn't know him in the lab. I knew him.
He got his PhD from Yale. He got his PhD, I think, in 29. He's older, much older than you. He's still alive, by the way, but just barely.
Yeah, I see. I haven't seen him for long.
I saw him. Last time I saw him was the funeral for his wife. And how about Carmen Conrad? Did you know him at a couple of...
I knew him later, but I didn't know him up there.
And, maybe he wasn't there in the early 40s.
Although there were people like Quigg and...
Q-U-I-G-G.
And,
I know that name. Well,
there's a whole bunch of guys that didn't stay.
A lot of famous DuPont chemists were up there then.
Well, Emmett Izzard was there. He worked on... I went to work for him. And
you remember, you're saying Izzard or Izzard?
Izzard.
Yeah, I-Z-A-R-D.
And he's the fellow who developed the...
You have some publications with him, I think, or some patents with him.
Yeah.
Publications or patents, or both.
And patents.
Yeah.
He was on cellulose and vinyl polymers, and then he was on the polyethylene terephthalate, and he did the original work for DuPont on polyethylene terephthalate before we learned about ICI.
Oh.
Well,
what do you think about the fact that that the English beat the DuPonters of the on the terephthalate?
I didn't understand it.
No, the terephthalate that was discovered and patented in England.
Oh, yeah.
And this small company, the ICI, ate up eventually.
Yeah.
I think it ate up for the
terephthalate. Yeah, Calico Printers was in there, and Cortal. And, they got the early patents, and DuPont got licenses under the patents.
And became the number one producer in the United States.
Yeah. And then DuPont actually produced the fiber here in this country before ICI got going.
And that's because of the research they did on the 6'6 nylon.
Yeah.
They had a good basis for developing another fiber.
Yeah.
Because I don't think ICI had really done anything on that after DuPont did.
That's right.
Because it's a very strong end now, though, in fiber production, ICI and England. So who was your first boss at Buffalo at DuPont? Who was your first boss?
That was Emmett Izzard.
Izzard.
Yeah. And
he was a good man to work with and work for.
He was great. He had
really,
been a
brilliant chemist.
He was a good organic chemist, and he had worked at the experimental station before he went up there, and on organic chemistry, plasticizers, and things like that.
How did DuPont feel about publications back in the 41, 42, 43, 44 period?
Well, there wasn't much going on.
Back then, didn't they discourage publications?
On the whole, I think they did. But
see, you have no publications at all from DuPont at that period.
No, about 19... Yeah, it's all
because then you have to go to the 1950s, I think, don't you, for your publications?
I got one... I had one in 40s.
About 48, but that's the water side of a gums. That was your book review. After that, I don't think... That's 46, the ethers and esters. The chemical companies didn't mind publishing on analytical procedures, but they didn't like the...
All of these are work that's done at NAWSEA at 51. Yeah, I came down to Wilmington in 50...
I have it here.
1950,
when he transferred to the experimental station, yes.
And these are on work that was done in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. That was done in Buffalo. That's not, all of these are in Buffalo. But
was there much problem clearing these papers in DuPont for publication?
Well, there wasn't.
Of course, not the analytical part.
They didn't undergo the kind of review that they do today. They went through the laboratory people, and then they went to W.W. Smith. And I guess
he was in patents back as far back as that W.W.
Yeah, he was in patents back at all that time. And
I should know that. I knew. I first met Will Smith in 1948 or 47. He was in patents then, yes.
They may have been shown to some other people, but there wasn't a very formal review other than going to the patent division.
Not like it is today, then.
Chatz was interested in publications, but I think the inspiration for this hadn't come from primarily from the chemists, and it's almost always been that way.
Then you really had a desire to publish your results.
Yes, that's right.
How do you account for the fact that so few of us do publish? Is it laziness to write? Or is it that they have nothing to say?
Well, there's two things, or at least two things. One is laziness.
Because writing is hard.
It takes a certain amount of get up and go to do that, and an interest. But the chemist is discouraged from it in a number of ways. One is nobody's saying we want you to publish very often. Sometimes you do. But it doesn't get him very much either. He sees it as not getting him any more pay. It doesn't get him any credit within the company much.
But it puts him down in the history of chemistry.
Yeah, it does. So he has to want that. He has to see that as a
goal. But don't you think most of the good chemists have that desire to go down in history as being a good chemist?
I don't see that. I don't understand it. I don't see it in the chemist.
But you had it.
Yeah. And I had some colleagues who had that too.
Should I turn this off?
There's somebody in the back.
Oh. Okay, we're on the air again.
Well, the thing we were talking about was publications, and I guess I'm talking primarily from my own experience in the laboratory, but most people, most chemists, don't see that they're going to gain advancement or low pay from publication. Now, I agree with you that sure they're going to get to go to meetings if they want to. It's a crutch for doing that. But they're also, the other side of this too, is that they're discouraged from publications by the review process. They go over all the work of writing it, and then people knock it down, say it isn't good enough, say it's faulty, and they have to review it.
Right. Or reveal so much information to your competitors.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So they get called on that, and on, and the process of review within the company is so extensive that it's just very discouraging, and they give up after a few tries. And it's only a selected few that push and push and keep on trying. So, out of 100 chemists that were in the lab where I worked, probably only half a dozen or so have publications.
Well, that's pretty high for the percentage of people, total chemists who publish.
Yeah.
You're talking about 6-7%.
I suppose so.
It's about 1 or 2% of us are
published. Is that right? I never.
For any of our PhD thesis, we all publish our PhD thesis.
Yeah.
Now, when did you become involved in polymer chemistry? And the cellulose, I know it's a
You're
polymer.
Not going to call
it no, I'm talking about the synthetic polymers now.
when I got promoted to research associate, that was back in 1945 or 6, somewhere in there. That publication on that's one of the first things that came out of that.
That's the dicarboxylic acid and esters containing the phosphine oxide group.
Yeah, I started as a research associate. I started a program on polymers with phosphorus links.
What really came out of that?
What came out of that?
Yes.
Nothing.
I knew the answer, that's why I asked the question.
Well, at that time
but it was interesting chemistry, wasn't it?
It was interesting chemistry, and we had the idea that changing linkages might change the properties of the polymers, but if you only put a small amount in, they get buried in there, and they're no different than carbon. And we had programs on putting in sulfur and silicon and phosphorus and so on.
Well, but there again, if you after you made the polymer and reacted these things further, you could have cross-linked.
Well, that's another possibility of cross-linking.
You didn't go that far, though, back those days.
That one. The thing that I missed in there, and you always look back and see what you missed, was the polyphosphazines. I worked on them for a while, but never got very far. And now we have Alcock with his great program in that area. And it was there.
You're talking about the Alcott of Penn State?
Yeah. It's one of those things that you could have discovered if you'd done the right thing.
I imagine you have a lot of instances like that in your career where...
Yeah, you do. There's all kinds of things like that.
I can say the same thing.
Yeah, including, yeah.
Well, then, when did you get into the interfacial conversation?
Well, that didn't come until we were down here in Wilmington, and that's 1951. I did that nylon trip experiment in early 1951.
Oh, you didn't publish until late 1950s,
though. Oh, yeah, it came out. We talked at the Gordon Conference in 1957.
That was the first announcement of it, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then we talked in Chicago ACS, and publications came out in 59.
Yeah. For which you got the Delaware Section Best Paper Award.
Right.
You and Stephen Kwolek. Is that how you pronounce it? Kwolek?
Kwolek, yeah.
Kwolek. K-W-O-L-E-K.
Right.
This is for the typist so they can transcribe it properly. Now, Stephanie was your laboratory partner almost from the very beginning, wasn't she?
Yeah, she had worked for other chemists. But
she was up there in Buffalo the same time you were.
Yeah, but she hadn't worked for me up there.
When you were transferred.
When I transferred down here.
But she transferred the same time you were transferred?
Yes, that's right.
And then was she assigned to you then?
About that time she went to work with me, and yeah, she worked with me for 25 years.
Yeah, I know. And actually, now, what, when she first worked for you, what sort of chemist was she? She was basically a BS chemist.
She was a research chemist.
She was a research chemist when she was assigned to you?
Yes. And she eventually became a research associate.
Because your father became a senior research associate, though. Your final time as a senior research associate, though. Well, what sort of impression did she make on you when she was first assigned to you? Did you know she was a hotshot chemist from the word go, or were you the professor that made her a hotshot chemist?
Well, I suppose some of the things rubbed off, but one never knows. She was a very careful, meticulous experimenter. She had worked for Izzard in Buffalo.
Oh, so he taught her a great deal, didn't he?
But that was when I was a research associate, I guess. I was away from Izzard by then, and on my own. She was working for him, and she also worked for Emerson Whitbacker for a while. She's a smart chemist, and
she do a lot of reading and studying during this period.
She does. Yeah, she reads the literature carefully and searches it carefully.
Did you use her for doing your literature searching, helping you in your own literature searching, or did you do your own? Did you do your own literature searching, or did you assign a lot to her?
Well, we worked in the same laboratory a lot of it, most of the time.
But she always reported to you, though, didn't she? You were always her boss.
Yeah, I was her boss working in the lab on the other side of the lab. But, I made a special effort not to be leaning over her shoulder. That's a hard on a person.
Yeah.
So we got along very well. And she had separate assignments, although frequently we worked on programs that were very close, where she had one part of it and I had the other part, that kind of thing. And they were programs that were side by side. And other times she had programs that were quite different from what I was doing.
Did she ever get a patent with only her name on it, or was all her patents with your name? I'm talking as long as you were at the experimental station.
Yeah, she
has patents in her name alone.
Patents in
while she was still reporting to you.
That's right.
Yeah. So you were running a race. Who had the most patents?
No, she's got quite a few, though. She's probably got more than...
She had an awful lot of with your name first.
She's got more than most of the chemists in the laboratory. They've got a display in the hall in the laboratory of people's pictures now. They didn't have it then. And then under them are the patents that they have.
How about publications? Do they have that for publications, too?
No, they don't have publications up there.
Publication is secondary in industry, huh?
Yeah, they have another display on another area that has some of the awards that we've won, and I'm in there, and she is, and some other people. But that's a separate thing. Well, you see, they're not paying as much attention to publications they are to patents. Well, there's a peculiar thing about patents, of course, and that is we have to keep notebooks and keep records. And
well, you do for publications, too, don't you?
And what?
You do for publications, too. I mean, your publications are based on your records, too. Mm-hmm.
What I'm leading up to is that in better publication authorship can be rather different than inventorship.
That's right, because then no one has to look at your records for the publication, they do for the patents.
Well, patents has got to be the records, and you've got to be the first, and you've got to have a concept, and you've got to do something back, and you've got to be the first one. And
have you ever lost a patent because you did not record the idea at the right time? It's a tough one.
It's kind of a tough one, but
I'm sure it happened. But just like Carruthers on his terephthalate.
I've lost them by not doing, I have not lost them fast by not recording them, but by not taking that thought
and working on it
and working on it and doing the experiment
within a year of the
and writing a letter or a note or something to somebody else, even though I had somebody witness the notebook. That's not enough always. And
reduction of practice is the
you have to practice it somehow.
That's where you lost out in some patents. Reduction of practice.